The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Attrape des deux mains une grande cuillère en bois dressée devant toi. Touille largement une première fois, puis une deuxième. Plonge la cuillère entre tes jambes, lance-la vers le ciel en sautant. La bulle d'air s'envole, suis-la du regard vers le ciel. Bouge le dos, c'est bien. Plus grand.
Well, hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. It was probably one of the weirdest opening clips that we've begun with, but I want to talk to you a bit today about, in some ways, why those kind of clips are so dangerous. Now, if you're listening on KPCG, if you're listening on our partners on CRN Digital Radio or Digital Talk Radio on CRN3, that was probably even weirder. Just some strange music and a voice speaking softly in French. Those joining us on our website, thetrumpet.com, you get the full video. However you're listening, we're very glad to have you. But that was an interpretive dance routine performed at the European Parliament. Hard to imagine something like that being performed in the House of Commons or the US Congress for good reason. But That was Monday. Now, Monday was a big moment for Europe. They were calling it Europe Day. It's the anniversary of the Schuman Declaration and kind of the European Union project getting going. And it was the conclusion of a year-long kind of big project that was meant to move Europe forward and help create a much bigger, a much closer European Union, kind of a big moment on a stepping stone towards a European superpower. It's designed to be something a bit like a constitutional convention. They had the Conference on the Future of Europe had been going for a year. They had thousands of citizens from across the EU got involved. In a lot of ways, it was kind of bureaucrats trying to get people to say what they wanted them to say. But it was meant to be a big moment for pushing Europe to become this kind of a superstate. And then it's hard to take seriously because they kicked it off with a 10-minute interpretive dance routine. That's right. Those 30 seconds were painful enough, but it was 10 minutes of that. And the narrator, of course, was in French. Unless you speak French, you probably don't understand what they were saying. But some of the words that the narrator was saying include things like, you have just arrived on the moon. Your hands become fish. You discover a new planet. Here, plants have taken power. And you know, 10 minutes of that. It's one of the first times I think I felt sorry for members of the European Parliament. They are very amply compensated, by the way, for having to sit through that kind of thing. They even voted themselves a special low tax rate, lower than anybody else in the European Union. They get very generous salaries and even more generous perks, so we don't need to feel too sorry for them for being forced to sit through 10 minutes of interpretive dance. But, like I said, in some ways videos like that can be dangerous. The natural reaction is to laugh at it. The EU, to many people, is a joke. I did see a PJ Media, they had a pretty funny article about exactly this. You know, let's all have a snigger at the European Union. It can seem that the greatest danger posed by the European Union is that you might die of vicarious embarrassment. But if you look at the substance of what was talked about on Monday and ignore some of the ridiculous ways that it was presented, and there was some significant news there. And Europe right now is being pushed forwards in this direction that we've said that Europe would go in for decades. And it's really quite a dangerous direction. And the interpretive dance routines just blind us and hide the fact that there's something much more sinister going on here. So this conference for the future of Europe, Emmanuel Macron, he kind of championed a lot of what was put forward by this conference. And he used this occasion to push for a new Europe, where you would have a smaller inner core of European countries that would move forwards towards unity. And then you'd have an outer core that would be much looser, that would be open. He even offered, said, you know, the UK, you could come join the outer core. Or Ukraine, he talked about, well, it's going to take decades for Ukraine to be able to join the EU proper. But if we split it into this inner core, outer core, well, then maybe Ukraine, you could come join the outer core. Both Macron and this proposal, they had some pretty significant things they were putting forwards. One would get rid of the need for unanimity on things like foreign policy and defense. That's a huge stumbling block for the EU. This need for unanimity is a big reason why the EU is a joke on the international scene, because one country can just torpedo everything. One of the students was reminding me of a news story from a few years ago. He's from Canada, and it was when the EU and Canada had pretty much, they'd agreed a trade deal. It was all done. They just needed everybody to sign off on it. But because it needs unanimity, there was one province in Belgium blocked Belgium from signing it, and then Belgium blocked the entire EU from going into force. So half of Belgium can stop this massive juggernaut from moving forwards. That's not sustainable. And it's why, you know, part of the reason why the EU can be a bit of a joke sometimes. And then, so they want to get rid of this. They want to get rid of that for defense. So the EU can send in European soldiers places without having to get consent of everybody involved. That's a big change. And both of those changes, if they can bring them about, would go a long way to making the EU less of a joke. That's not going to be an easy process, though. Six nations have backed those changes so far. 13 have said, no, you know, we're fine with the way they are. And that's why Emmanuel Macron and even Scholz in Germany are kind of talking more and more about this two-speed Europe idea, where an inner core go much further, and they're happy to kind of merge their militaries in the way that this talks about, while those 13 other countries get to be part of the outer core. But the Bible tells us there are big changes coming to Europe. It's not going to just be interpretive dance from here on out. I've just got a couple of quotes here. I'll just summarize. But Eurointelligence had a write up just talking about how big of a deal it would be if it's approved, but then also how much work it would take to get it to be approved. There's a lot of pro EU media are very much in favor of what is happening here. We have an article on our website, After the Russia Invasion, Time for a United States of Europe. And that talks about what some of the pro-EU media are saying about this conference and about these proposals. Euractiv it was an opinion article, Time for the United States of Europe. Time for the United States of Europe. And this was an article signed by over 200 intellectuals and people from all across 20 different European countries. So they're saying, well, after Russia invades, well, here we go, I'll just read it to you. We European citizens are scared by the return of war at the heart of Europe. The Russian invasion of Ukraine exposes the weaknesses and dependencies of the European Union and its member states. It goes on to say, European and especially Ukrainian citizens are suffering for the costs of non-Europe in the fields of energy, fiscal, foreign and defense policy. And they're calling on Europe to do more. And especially coordinate more on defense. Our Trumpet article goes through and also talks about how this is changing opinions within Europe. 77% of Europeans said they would favor a common defense and security policy. So this would be a major step in the direction of a European army. And a lot of Europeans are okay with that. A majority, 57%, said more decisions should be made at the EU level. And these statistics came from before the invasion of Ukraine. Those have even gotten further. There was a much less noticed event that came on Monday that's also worth paying attention, that kind of went hand in hand with the interpretive dance routine and the Conference of Europe and Europe Day. And on this day, Vatican News, they published an article, The church, a faithful companion on path to European Union. And this had some material from Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich, who's the president of the Commission of the Bishops' Conference of the EU. And he wrote, or he had a statement, Faithfulness to European Values, that he published in because of this day. And he wrote, the Catholic Church, its successive popes since Pius XII, the European bishops, religious orders, and many Christian movements of laity have never stopped to wholeheartedly embrace the process of European unification and its underlying values. I think it's probably not a great translation, but he's talking about how the Catholic Church has wholeheartedly embraced this push towards European Union. So he went on to endorse that. So we're seeing a European Union that's pushing for change, a Catholic Church that's saying, well, we encourage, we support this change, we're supporting this push towards an ever closer union. Meanwhile, in Germany, there's a growing appetite for change. The day before we had this conference on Europe, there was an important regional election within Germany. So the German state of Schleswig-Holstein, where the CDU, this is Angela Merkel's party, they had a historic win, 43.4% of the vote, an increase of 11.4% over previous years. Meanwhile, the SPD, the government that's currently in power, the party that's currently running the country, they lost nearly 12 percentage points. They only got 16% of the vote. The Green Party, this junior coalition party, they overtook them. Politico's, they titled their article, Scholz's Social Democrats Suffer Crushing Defeat. So you're seeing a Germany as well that is wanting something very different from what they've got, looking for a new type of leader. We'll get into that. I'll talk about that in just a minute. But before we do that, I'll just cover another piece of news just from these last few days that is really going to get Germans hungering for new leadership. This is from German Foreign Policy, the Euro Crisis 2.0. And they talked about how you've got the potential for a major economic crisis in Europe again right now. And I think this is something that's really worth paying attention to and very easy to overlook. The problems that inflation is causing in Britain and America, we tend to focus on those because they impact us very directly on a daily basis. You know, when you go to fill up at the pump, etc. Last time I filled up with diesel, I looked it up. I converted it over into dollars per gallon. $18.15 per gallon is how much it costs in the UK to fill up with diesel. So obviously the inflation crisis, kind of that aspect of it, the cost of living, that very directly affects us. It's very much on our minds. But we also need to pay attention to what this could do for Europe. It's raising some big, big problems for Europe. You've got this situation where Germany in particular is terrified of inflation. Completely understandably so. They know the dangers and the damage that out of control inflation can do. They went through that experience during the 1930s. Where people had their entire savings wiped out, their life savings or their pensions just wiped out because of runaway inflation. So they're very concerned about the inflation rate. And just like in Britain, just like in America, inflation is very high in Europe right now. And the German representative in the European Central Bank, Isabel Schnabel, she's demanding that the ECB do something about this, take urgent action, raise interest rates, stop printing money, that they need to urgently deal with this growing inflation. And you know, that makes a lot of sense. And you're seeing other central banks do this. The Federal Reserve increased interest rates by 0.5 percentage point. I think that's the first time they've done that since the 1990s. That's a fairly significant step. I'm skeptical how much it will help inflation, I guess, but they've taken that step. The Bank of England as well, they've raised interest rates several times now. So British interest rates are quite high, and the European Central Bank has done nothing much. And Germany's getting very upset about this. But the trouble is that you've got all of Southern Europe is absolutely addicted to low interest rates and the European Central Bank printing money and buying their debt. That's what's keeping these countries afloat. And some of these countries in Southern Europe are in massive amounts of debt. And, you know, it felt like several years ago, we were kind of talking about the euro crisis all the time. And it's gone away, not because any of the fundamental issues behind that have been fixed, but because the European Central Bank has been papering over it all by, you know, paper money, with printing money and using that to just kind of make it go away. Nobody's struggling to pay off their debts because if Italy wants to borrow money, the European Central Bank will lend it to them. And they're just printing the money to be able to do that. If the European Central Bank stops printing money, if they start raising interest rates, immediately Italy is in major financial trouble. And they're not the only ones. They can't survive without doing this. So you've got this situation where the European Central Bank's temporary fix for the crisis is causing massive runaway inflation. And you know, then there's other factors behind the outbreak of inflation as well, aside from the European Central Bank policy, because we see it in Britain, we see it in America, though both countries are doing the same kind of money printing. So it's still a factor. But anyway, you've got now runaway inflation. The ECB just can't keep printing money. They can't keep doing this. And that's going to cause major crises for Europe. Italy, their debt is 160% of the economy, massively indebted. And it's not just Italy, France, Spain, they've got very high levels of debt as well. I think what is really interesting is Germany has been shrinking their debt burden over the last 10 years. Their debt to economy ratio has shrunk by about 11%. So effectively, they're reducing their debt. Meanwhile, all these other countries have only increased their debt since the euro crisis. Spain, their debt ratio is up by 70%, France 29%, Italy 26%. So these countries have continued to borrow money while Germany has been prudent and planned for the future. So I think you can really see now why Germans would be feeling miffed. You know, this money printing is not being done for us, it's being done for Southern Europe. We've been responsible, we've been paying back our debt, but now we look to have all of our savings wiped out by massive inflation, and the European Central Bank doesn't appear to be doing much because of Southern Europe and other countries borrowing debt. So you can see how this is really building towards a crisis as well, where you've now got the potential for the European Central Bank being forced to stop this money printing, and then you could have this euro crisis explode. So you've got Vladimir Putin causing a crisis for Europe and causing Europe to say, well, you know, we need a new military. We need to make these changes. We need to come together and be more of a super state. The Catholic Church is right there saying, well, we're behind that. You've got the potential for economic crises to do that. And then, as I mentioned, you've got a lot of appetite for change just within Germany itself. You're getting some very quick changes. You know, we've talked a lot about the massive military transformation that Germany announced back at the end of February, just days after Russia invaded, where Germany came out and said, OK, we're doubling our military budget. We're going to change our whole approach to the armed forces. We're going to be a more muscular, more powerful country. And since then, appetite within Germany for that has only grown. You had a recent poll found that 41% of Germans saying that the German government is not going far enough. And now you're starting to see this growing appetite for a strong leader within Germany. This is what you saw at the weekend when the German ruling party did really badly, spectacularly badly, in the local elections. I think everyone expected it to be bad. Nobody expected it to be quite that bad. Where Olaf Scholz is now just seen as weak and dithering. And people are then desperate for even more change in Germany. And they want a strong man to come in and bring this about. Spiegel Online, a month or so ago, they had a profile of the Chancellor. It was called, "Where's Olaf Scholz? German Chancellor opts for a low profile at moment of crisis." They wrote that after 4 months in office, Scholz remains an invisible Chancellor to many, a political hermit crab who only rarely emerges from his shell. And at the moment, only 19% of Germans are optimistic about the future. That's from a poll from Germany's oldest polling institute. So they've got all of these worries, all of these anxieties with what's going on in Ukraine, worries about the economy. and a leader that's just nowhere to be found. Schultz gave a TV interview and he was talking about Putin and he said he was scared. He was scared by what Putin was doing. And one Green Party politician, Marina Weisband, she said that that interview was like a punch in the stomach. Wherever the world looks at him, you can see he is so scared and overwhelmed, she wrote. No, he's just scared. Meanwhile, it's not just Germans that want Germany to step up. The rest of the world is calling for that as well. NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg. This is last week, I think, or at least the Trumpet article that we had on this. The website article went up last week. Germany has a leading role in defending NATO's east flank. We leave no room for misunderstanding or miscalculation. There's a lot of people calling on him to do more. Here's another, Spiegel wrote that Schultz has tended to approach the historic challenges he is now facing just as he used to address the housing shortage in Hamburg or the push to establish a global minimum corporate tax rate. They wrote that he sees that German people are scared, but then they went on to describe how he is just unable to connect with them or to really address their fears. So he's been in office barely 6 months and there's already talk of replacing him. Friedrich Merz, he's the leader of the right-wing Christian Democrat Party. He's the successor to the party Angela Merkel used to lead, but he is quite different from Angela Merkel. He is the one that Angela Merkel beat when she kind of got the nomination. So he's from a very different wing of the party. He's much more to the right within that party. But he presents himself as a much stronger, more competent leader. And people are speculating that, well, if Schultz doesn't make some big changes soon, he could see his coalition partners defect, and he could see Merz coming into the Chancellor's office. And this could happen very quickly. It wouldn't require fresh elections, just a different coalition. So what all of this amounts to is something that we've been forecasting for years. You've got all of these different pressures now pushing for a changed Germany, a new Germany, and a changed Europe and a new Europe. And that's exactly what these leaders were talking about on Monday. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue with this and just talk about the history and prophecy that says we need to watch for this changed Europe and this changed Germany.
The Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States. Hoorah! One in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror. Their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe. And it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back. We've been talking about some of the news events of the last few days, how they're pushing for a changed Europe, and about how so many underestimate what a changed Europe could look like, what a changed Europe could do, what the value even of these news events is. Because in many ways, Europe looks harmless or even ridiculous. But this is not the first time that Europe or even Germany has looked harmless or ridiculous. In 1813, Madame de Stael published a book called On Germany. And in this book, she kind of ridiculed Germany as a military power. Nothing is odder than the German soldiers, she wrote. They fear fatigue or bad weather, as if they're all shopkeepers or literati, you know, book reviewers, something like that. Wood-burning stoves, beer and tobacco smoke create a heavy and warm atmosphere around them, which is difficult for them to leave. They're just lazy and they would just like to sit inside around wood fires, smoking and drinking or whatever. But this kind of idea of Europe being a bit useless and a bit of a joke is what a lot of people think of Europe right now. And even of Germany. Luigi Bardini, he had a book called The Europeans, and he quoted a fair bit from Madame de Stael in that. This came out, I think, in the 1980s. But he compared Germany to Proteus, this shape-shifting old man of the sea. And he talked about how dramatic changes are very common. He wrote that the Germans emerged from the stove-heated rooms filled with pipe smoke in 1870. They crossed the border of France as a grey-tide of faceless, disciplined soldiers with spiked helmets, a relentless, unstoppable war machine. Where had they come from? Only a few Germans and no foreigner had suspected what the imminent metamorphosis would be like. A bit later, he said, weeping French writers went on for decades telling innumerable heartbreaking stories of how ruthless, rapacious, and contemptuous the invaders had been. How could these Germans be so dissimilar from those harmless people, peaceful people Madame de Stael had described, those whom Europe had known and loved only a few years before? So, Germany is certainly no stranger to this kind of transformation. People looked at Germany as a bit of a joke, and then they became this grey, tideless mass. And Barzini has quite a few statements in this book about just how quickly these kind of changes came about in German history. But when can we expect that kind of a transformation? Well, Barzini wrote that Germany is, as it always was, a mutable, Proteus-like, unpredictable country, particularly dangerous when it is unhappy. When it's unhappy, that's when you can get some of these massive transformations. We had, several years ago, we had Nicholas Frank come to visit us here at Edstone. You might remember, if you are a really long-time listener, I think we did a special Trumpet Daily show with him where Mr. Stephen Flurry interviewed him for just about the whole time. And one of the things that he talked about was pretty much this exact same thing, that Germany can change very quickly, and that that crises can cause this to happen. He talked about how Germany would be calm, peaceful, even pacifistic when times were good and they felt secure. But if times changed, if you have an economic crisis, for example, like we talked about the potential for in the first half, this could change very quickly. Here's what he said in one of the interviews. This is clip four.
I think I have told it before. It's as long as we are dominating Europe with our industry, everything is okay. But if they dare to take away our money, then it will become dangerous.
And this is what you see over Ukraine. The way even that Germany will have nothing, is really reluctant to put any sanctions on Russia, keeps putting the brakes on meaningful sanctions on Russia. Part of that is there's a whole lot of these business leaders that have an agenda in Russia, and we've talked about this before, and part of it is that they're not willing to sacrifice any of their economic prosperity or jeopardize any of that. As long as they're on top, though, economically, they're okay. But now Germany, they're more pessimistic than they've ever been since World War II. They want something different. They're loudly demanding a transformation. They want to become more militaristic. They want to be doubling the spending on their armed forces. They're crying out for a strong leader. You know, all of these bits of evidence points to the fact that we're seeing Germany change now, exactly the way they have in their history. And Bible prophecy gives us an even stronger warning of this change coming to Germany. Revelation 17 describes this power within Germany, this beast power. It describes it as, the Bible talks, or a beast in biblical symbolism is an empire. And Revelation 17 and verse 8 says, the beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell upon the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life and the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is and yet is. So there's this massive war-making machine, but it was and it is not, and yet it is. In his book, Prophesy Again, or booklet, Prophesy Again, Mr. Gerald Flurry, he wrote, that's a befuddling statement. Many people read something like that and just throw up their hands and say, nobody can understand this book, but it's really simple if you'll just let God show you. Mr. Armstrong spent much of his ministry discussing this subject. So he went on to explain, well, you understand this, you understand that time period, and then you can start to understand this was and is not and yet is. He writes, during World War II, we saw the Hitler-Mussolini axis, but then it disappeared from the scene. It was not. And yet God says it is. The Axis powers lost the war, but as Mr. Armstrong preached time and again, they just went underground into the bottomless pit. That's what verse 8 talks about. They're still there. They're underground. And God says after this happens, they're going to ascend right back up. And then Christ is going to come back and destroy the beast and it will be gone forever. So this is what happens with Europe. This is what happens with Germany. It made the world shake in the 1940s. It was the beast that was. And then after that, it disappeared. It is not. But it's still there. It's just underground. It is. It's still in existence. And it's coming back from underground. You can see that in so many of these bits of news events. You can see that in the way that Germany is actively working to help Russia and to bring down the United States. That's the beast returning from the underground. But to so many people, it still remains hidden. It still remains underground. They could see it if they paid better attention to these news events. But it's underground. They could see it much even more clearly if they were paying attention to the Bible. But instead, they're distracted by, or they, they just see the ridiculous interpretive dance or whatever, and write the EU off as a joke. Mr. Flurry had his Key of David program this weekend. Watch and Pray he started talking about Europe, and he started out this program talking about what is going on right now in Europe. But then he talked about how, well, we need to watch, if we're going to really understand this, we need to watch and pray. We need to be talking to God. We need to be getting God's input so that we can understand world events. Otherwise, we're not. We need to be going to him and we need to be studying our Bibles. And if you haven't watched that Key of David, I'd really encourage you to do so. I think it was called Watch and Pray. I didn't have anything in my notes on that, but I'm pretty sure that is the title. But if we let God show us what's happening, well, we need to be very concerned with some of the things that are happening in Europe. And there are even news stories that really do expose the fact that this Nazi spirit, say, is not completely gone. And there was one just this week that kind of went a bit viral, where Lufthansa, this German national airline, this German carrier, they banned all Jews from boarding a particular flight. And, I saw the headline, I couldn't believe it. It was like reading something out of 1930s Germany. No Jews allowed on this flight. If people were wearing any clothing or anything that made them obviously look like a Jew, they were not allowed to board. And this is in the 21st century. There's clearly something there in that with anti-Semitism and the Nazi spirit that is not dead. And what happened here, a couple of Jews refused to wear a face mask. The face masks were all because they're stupid. You do whatever you need to fly. But a couple of Jews did refuse to wear a face mask. And so for one of the connecting flights, they said, okay, well, we're not going to let any Jews fly. We've got a video. We can play a clip. This is of a real, genuine 21st century Lufthansa representative saying no Jews were welcome on a particular flight.
We have to get there. I'm not with the group. I understand that pilot made a decision. We don't question pilots' decisions, but apparently we're banned. There are other Lufthansa flights. Is this a Lufthansa decision that all Jewish people that were on that flight can't go on any flight today? Because this is 2022, and this is a Western country. So this has to go up to upper management, because this is like anti-Semitism.
The upper management was...
Yeah, so we would like to talk to upper management, because this is 2022, this is a Western country,
I know, yes.
And there's a lot of history of anti-Semitism throughout the world.
We will, and this is gruesome. We will discuss about the history of
Israel. No, this is gruesome. This is like, unbelievable.
I have a question.
It would happen if you were African or if you were Hollander.
What's the rule?
So why am I will bring a mask the whole time. Why am I lumped in with them?
I know it was one. Everybody has to pay for a couple of.
So but how come there was 16? Everybody from that race?
From
no, everybody else on the flight went. So why
not
am I
everybody
paying? The non-Jewish people on the flight went. So why did Jewish people pay for other people's crimes?
Because it's Jewish coming from JFK.
Jewish people coming from JFK are paying for the crimes of the same people.
Do
you pay for the crimes of Israel?
No.
Just the Jewish people on that flight?
Do you want to discuss with me or do you want to listen to me?
I'm shocked beyond.
Yes,
I've never, in my adult
Jewish
life, I've never
people,
heard this.
If you want to do this, like these Jewish people who were the mess, who made the problems.
So Jewish people on the plane made a problem, so all Jews are banned from Lufthansa for the day.
Just for this flight.
It's just astonishing. I think it's also astonishing that there's not more outrage against that. I mean, imagine if a black couple had refused to wear masks on this plane, and so then Lufthansa had said, well, okay, no black people are allowed on this plane, on this flight. It would have caused outrage around the world. And there's not really been a huge amount of outrage. And the Lufthansa, they put out a kind of a non-apology where they didn't even mention Jews or anti-Semitism in their apology at all. But for them, and for so many, I mean, if you think about how many, none of the members of staff kind of said, hang on a minute. Even leaving aside the moral implications here, for a prominent German airline to ban Jews from boarding a flight, that is not a good look. You know, nobody said that. Nobody thought that. It just seemed completely reasonable and normal to the whole hierarchy involved here. That's kind of astounding. For them, it just, okay, well, yep, no Jews on the flight. That's fine. I mean, that shows that there's a certain spirit there of anti-Semitism. And I'm sure the people behind that are the type of people who would never dream of showing up to some of these far-right rallies that you might see on TV. But they were still quite comfortable saying no Jews on the flight. You know, that shows that there are some major problems underground, you could say. And this is something Nicholas Frank talked about when we interviewed him as well. Jacob brought this clip up because it came right after the other one that I asked him to look for. But here's what he had to say about this kind of spirit of anti-Semitism.
We still nowadays, after our experience during the 12 years, there's in the midst of our society is a big anti-Semitism, and this is growing. Again, we build up a lot of monuments for our victims, for our Jewish victims, but this don't count for society majority. Right. Never experienced the march of 20 or 30 million Germans against the anti-Semitism in Germany or against the right-wing parties.
So do you believe the Nazi spirit is alive today in Germany?
Yes.
And it's evident in the silent majority?
Yes.
Would you say after the war there was a repentance?
No. There was a repentance. There is no shame. Acknowledge that the German people didn't initiate any war the last 70 years. That's a good thing. But the next 70 years will follow. So be careful.
So, I mean, in some ways, it's a smaller news story. It's one airline refusing people boarding on one flight. But it's a symptom. It's a symptom of this beast underground. So this is what you're seeing is Bible prophecy coming alive as Germany looks to rearm and as Europe talks about coming together. I mean, this whole idea of a two-speed Europe, that's right out of the pages of Bible prophecy. The Revelation 17, the same chapter that we've been talking about, it talks about this beast having 10 horns and 10 kings. You're making clear that this is going to be made up of 10 nations or 10 groups of nations. And, well, that means Europe right now, what, they're 27, 28 nations, something like that, a long way out from 10. They've got to shrink down somehow. And this proposal for like a two-speed Europe, an inner Europe and an outer Europe, well, that could be exactly the way that they shrink down. That could be how this happens. And how you get a 10-nation European combine. And I think it will maybe take still a little more pressure, a little more of a crisis to make that happen. Like I mentioned, there's still several nations that are against this. There's still several nations that are reluctant to, say, give up control over their armed forces to have this kind of European super state. But that's where this is heading. They've got these things together, and you can see the potential crises on the horizon. What if Vladimir Putin uses weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine? He's not doing very well in Ukraine at the moment. And is he just going to turn around and leave with his tail between his legs? I don't think so. We certainly couldn't rule out him doing something like that. That could really shake Europe. We've got the financial crisis that we talked about. And if that hits, well, then you're going to see, just like they did in the last financial crisis, they'll take some significant steps towards becoming a united country. So don't be distracted by the interpretive dance. There is a very important reason to keep watching this story. This is a power that's going to shake, that's going to threaten the world. Of course, there's an even more important reason, and that is that the Bible lists this power as a major event, a major milestone on the road to the return of Jesus Christ. That's where the rise of this power is leading. That's why we need to keep locked in on this. As we see this power rising, well, that's going to show us how close that return of Christ is. That's going to help us be more urgent. Like Mr. Flurry talked about on the Key of David this weekend, that's going to help drive us to prayer, help us be more intense in our prayer. Really prioritize that, because we see, well, we're watching this power, we're watching the rise of this power. We can see that it's nearly there, that it's nearly out from that underground, that too few people see it, but that we can see we're getting very close now to the return of Jesus Christ. We need to urgently prepare for that. So there is wonderful news behind that as well, but like I said, we can't be distracted by the interpretive dance. This is a power that God calls a beast power, that says it's, in Habakkuk, talks about it being like the fierce as the evening wolves, that, you know, devours not just flesh, but crunches the bone as well. This is going to be a big change. And people are going to look back and they're going to say, well, where did this come from? We thought they were just this big joke with all their interpretive dance. Exactly the same way people look back on Germany and on German history and say this again, and have said this again and again in the past. The Bible tells us where this is leading, and we have to watch that. Well, I had another few stories I wanted to just blitz through. I guess I'll blitz through a couple of them very quickly. One of the big stories was the House passed a bill promising $14 billion to Ukraine. We got a clip from one Republican congressman who I thought made a very good point talking about this. This is clip one.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. The gentleman from Maryland talked about protecting this institution, or talked about this institution, but we got a $40 billion bill at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I haven't had a chance to review the bill. My staff is poring over the pages trying to see what's in it. You want to talk about the institution? You want to talk about standing up alongside Ukraine? Why don't we actually have a debate on the floor of the People's House instead of the garbage of getting a $40 billion bill at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, not paid for, without having any idea what's really in it, with a massive slush fund that goes to the State Department, $13 billion, $8 billion for the Economic Support Fund, $110 million for embassy security. We've got $40 billion that is unpaid for, and you want to sit here and lecture this body about what we're going to do or not do about standing alongside Ukraine? Why don't we talk about the American people who are hurting, the wide open borders, the inflation that's killing people, the jobs that people can't get because of the cost of goods and services in this country? Sitting here and being lectured to when I don't even have time to look at a $40 billion unpaid bill. I make a motion to adjourn.
It's a good point. I mean, I'm not really opposed to sending money to Ukraine in general. I mean, it seems like there's a potential for it to be a great low-cost way of defeating Russia, who's one of America's primary adversaries. You know, just fund some other army and let them exhaust the Russian troops. America doesn't have to send any men. It's kind of a great deal all round. But I mean, look at the speed, though, that they're putting these bills forward. And Joe Biden asked for $33 billion. The House says, oh, we'll up it for $40 billion. And he points out they just rush it through and they don't look at what's in it. There's no time to scrutinize it. It creates all of these slush funds. We already know that the Obama administration has some very dodgy links to Ukraine. There's all of the Hunter Biden and Burisma and all of this. Who knows where a whole lot of that money is slushing around to? I'm sure some of it will go on weapons for Ukraine, but what else is in that bill? What else is America paying for? And it's a vast amount of money. This is, you know, countries like Italy or Australia, they spending, I think, $30 billion on their military each year. This is dramatically more than the entire year's spending of some of these countries. And then it's more than America was spending annually for its own war in Afghanistan. It's just a mind-bogglingly huge sum of money. And of course, America's borrowing it. It's not like America's got $40 billion saved up for a rainy day. It is a gargantuan amount of money being spent with very little oversight. So I think that's something to be concerned of, to keep watching. And like I said, who knows exactly what the Obama administration is really doing with that. You also had an election in the Philippines with Ferdinand Marcos Jr. winning. So we've kind of, the Philippines are back with Marcos is in charge. And then Sero Duterte Carpio was elected as his vice president. I think they were both kind of elected by quite wide margins. So you've got the son of a former dictator and then the daughter of the current president on a joint ticket now running Ukraine. Running the Philippines. I've got Ukraine on the brain, I guess. So that will be interesting to watch it, that there's the chance that he could then bring the Philippines towards China potentially. He's kind of endorsed Duterte's rapprochement with China. I think he's made some vague statements. It's hard to know exactly what he's going to do, but you could well see the Philippines going towards a kind of a strongman era and maybe drawing closer to China as well. Well, I have, I guess, 7 or 8 minutes to fit in a bit of a Bible study towards the end here. I won't bother going for a break just to save myself a bit of time. But I did want to talk about, well, where are we in God's holy day calendar? You know, we talked about this countdown of world events and how the changes in Europe are a major part in that countdown, leading to the return of Jesus Christ. Well, God gives us another countdown, an annual countdown, an annual holy day calendar. And he gives us this to keep us focused on his plan. There are different lessons that he really emphasizes at different times of year, and it drives what we're studying and what we're thinking about. And God's holy days are tied in with the harvest in ancient Israel. And God really uses these harvests to teach us some powerful lessons. So I want to help you understand what these harvests teach us about God's plan of salvation. Because like I said, God structured his holy days around these harvests in ancient Israel. And we can see that from the Bible. The Bible talks about, and we'll turn to a couple of scriptures that talk about that, but it talks about two main harvests, and it really connects the holy days with that. But no one really outside of God's church talks about this. No one really talks about a spring harvest or an autumn harvest and the way that it connects with these holy days. The next kind of big event on the holy day calendar, still a few weeks out, is Pentecost. And this is a day that that a lot of Christian churches will say that they celebrate, unlike pretty much a lot of the other days on the holy day calendar. You will get quite a few, or at least some, of these worldly Christian holy days that will hold some kind of Pentecost service for those that want to come. Obviously, it's nowhere near as big on their calendar of holy days as these days like Christmas and Easter. But it is one of the few holy days mentioned in the Bible that some of these ones do have some kind of semblance of keeping. But they don't talk about, they don't connect it to this harvest at all. So you can look in Exodus chapter 23 first and just really show how these holy days connect to this harvest. But the first set of holy days, the days of unleavened bread, those days that we've come out of, they happen in the month of Abib, Abib means green ears. So God built his holy day calendar so that it would match up with the harvest and that the first month is directly tied to that harvest. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, it says Abib is not properly a name of the month, but part of a descriptive phrase, the month of young ears of grain. So God designed it so that you'd start with this month of young ears of grain. Then if we look in Exodus chapter 23 and verse 15, it says, "You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread." And this is in Abib, in the month of the young ears of grain. "And you shall eat unleavened bread 7 days as I command you in the time appointed of the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty." Smiley face. "And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is at the end of the year, when you have gathered in your labors out of the field, 3 times in the year all your male shall appear before the Eternal empty," or before the Eternal your God. So you have the feast of first fruits of your labors and the feast of ingathering. God clearly then and specifically connects Pentecost and then the autumn festivals to the harvest. He calls this Feast of Pentecost, well, the feast of harvest of the first fruits of your labors. You can look over in Deuteronomy 16 as well. We see this same principle here, that this holy day and this Feast of Pentecost relates directly to the harvest. It says, 7 weeks you shall number unto you, beginning to number the 7th week from such a time as you begin to put the sickle to the corn. And I'm not going to get into how exactly to calculate when Pentecost is, but harvest begins around the time of the days of unleavened bread, this first fruit harvest, and it lasts until Pentecost. So this time that we're in now, where we're in between these two, we've come out of the days of unleavened bread, we've got Pentecost still a few weeks away. We're during this period of harvest of the first fruits. That's what Israel would have been doing, gathering in the first fruit harvest. It would have been a very busy time of year for Israel, gathering in all of these crops. We have a farm opposite our house, and when it is harvest time, they work late into the night. They've got all kinds of powerful floodlights they've got on their machinery so that they can keep going almost around the clock. So they can get that harvest in before the rain comes and things get damp and they start to spoil. There's a real urgency in getting that harvest in. And so this would have been a very busy time for ancient Israel. And the Bible has many other passages that talk about, well, you have this bigger harvest in the autumn or running up to the autumn. Many scriptures kind of talk about these big harvests taking place during the heat of the summer as they're harvesting in late summer, getting ready for in the run-up to those autumn holy days. And then you've got this smaller first fruits harvest in the run-up to Pentecost. So was this just something that God instituted because, well, that was just a convenience? You know, it's a convenient time to have a big party maybe after all you've finished the harvesting. Or are there deeper spiritual lessons? Well, let's look in the New Testament at James chapter 1. And we can see clearly that there are deeper spiritual lessons that God wants us to get from this. James chapter 1 and verse 18 says, "Of his own will begat he us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures." God calls his church first fruits. And so God began his church on the Feast of Pentecost. He gave the Holy Spirit on the Feast of Pentecost on this Feast of First Fruits. God really ties his church to the first fruits. We can see that in Scripture. We can see that through the holy days as well. And these kind of Christian churches that may keep the Feast of Pentecost or have a day of Pentecost to some extent, well, they don't understand this. They don't connect this with this lesson. And there's so many lessons that we can learn from this. It teaches us so much. It teaches us that the church is just a part of a small group of first fruits. That God is not, this is not the only harvest for God. There is a much bigger harvest coming later. It helps drive home the purpose of the church. What even God has a church here for. And teaches so much about his plan. And you can read much more about that in our free book, booklet, Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, which that's about all I've got time for to talk about it. I had some quotes I was going to read, but if you haven't read that, I'd really encourage you to go and read that for yourself. So there is such deep meaning in this picture of harvest, and with this kind of strong foundation of proving that this comes from the Bible, I hope we can really bottom this out, and that I'm sure we'll talk more about these harvests, talk more about why the church, talk more about the Feast of Pentecost on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, it's been great to be with you. You can get in touch with the show at emailing us at td@thetrumpet.com if you have any questions or any comments, you can give us a call at 1-866-930-3024 to request any of this literature. And as always, please do tune in tomorrow.